Thoughts and Answers begins right now.
You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. For centuries, skeptics said that the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were just fables. In 2007, those fabled cities were brought to life from an extraordinary dig. Today, the world's skeptics have changed their tune. The last time we were together, Pat began an interview with Dr. Stephen Collins, one of the leading biblical archaeologists of today, and he will continue on with the discoveries that were found in the city of Sodom. If you've missed any part of this broadcast, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this interview entitled In Search of the City of Sodom, and find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now, let's conclude.
What happened, one of those proxies, and I didn't mention this one of those proxies in that destruction layer is a high level of Dead Sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that it came in shallow, exploded, went to critical mass over the north end of the Dead Sea. It's the only way to explain the salt. And so when that thing exploded, and as it's coming in, it pushed vast quantities of vaporized Dead Sea water and vaporized salt up over the landscape, which became part of the permanent matrix of the destruction of Tal Hamam. In the destruction layer of the time of Abraham at Tal Hamam, there is a 6 times more concentration of Dead Sea salt than there is in the Dead Sea water.
Hmm.
How did that get so salty? Well, it got salty probably because of this event that just pushed this up over the landscape and just seeded the landscape with all of this vaporized salt. What's interesting about that is if Lot's wife had gone south towards Zoar, which she did, the Bible tells us, she had headed south towards Zoar, which is down toward the southern end of the Dead Sea, or about actually around the Wadi Mujib, which is maybe about a half a day, 3/4 of a day ride on a donkey. She stopped and turned back. We don't know if she's walking back or she just turned back and looked. But obviously she stopped on the margin of the blast zone. Had she been in the blast zone, she'd have been vaporized.
Hmm.
But she was evidently far enough on the margin where what happens is that as that salt was pushed up over the landscape, the whole landscape, including her, was covered with salt.
Hmm.
And it instantly, of course, hardened as a crust over the whole landscape, including her. Well, obviously, she was covered with it and it just encrusted her. She didn't even have time to fall down because it was enough heat where the water just vaporized out. And this salt just went from being vaporized to being solid again in a very quick kind of interval. That we think that's what happened to her. She became a pillar of salt. Now, we all know that Dead Sea salt is highly water soluble. So in a few rainy seasons, she would have melted away.
Oh, yeah.
So when somebody takes you to the Holy Land, they say, oh, see that little spire up there? That's Lot's wife.
Yeah.
Don't believe it, because there's lots of them. In fact, there's one that has several spires. It's like Lot and his daughter and his dog.
Yeah. That's an incredible find. I mean, what is the significance of this discovery? I think it's a game changer here because, even now, you pick up so many commentaries on the Pentateuch and, they say, well, a lot of this is non-historical, or it's written, the Wellhausen theory, what you mentioned, JEPD, written by a group of priests, maybe in the 6th or 7th century kind of thing. But a discovery like this, account that pretty much, I rarely found a book that would acknowledge this as historical. Is this discovery a game changer here?
I think it certainly is. It's the biggest, most important discovery relative to the historicity of the Old Testament, I think, ever. Because here's, what's the most doubted book in the Old Testament? Book of Genesis.
Yeah, Genesis.
Most criticized, most doubted.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably one of the most doubted stories, right? This is crazy. Oh, this doesn't happen. Great fiery cataclysm comes out of the sky and consumes a whole civilization. No, this kind of thing doesn't happen. Well, guess what? with Ptolemy. By the way, it's not just Ptolemy, it has a whole bunch of cities around it,
Yeah.
just as the Bible describes. And so they're all in the right place and the right time, the right stuff and the right destruction. Everything is exactly as the Bible describes it. Now, what do you do with that? You'll really only have two choices. It's either completely a coincidence, totally accidental, or what we're finding is descriptive of is the physical evidence left behind by the biblical story of Sodom. Those are the only two choices. Now, since we have the goods, and I'm talking about the evidence, the archaeology, the astrophysics, everything that goes with it, all of that exists. That's not going away. So you can either choose to believe that there is a foundational, historical, foundational story of a real meteoritic airburst event in the time of Abraham that destroyed an entire civilization of Sodom and Gomorrah, and you can accept that somehow it found its way into the Bible, or ignore it. There are people who will ignore it. They don't want to deal with it because they know what it means. If I accept the historicity of this, do I then have to accept the historicity of the characters in the story? Where do I go from there? If this much is historical and not mythical, which it now is known not to be, this is historical stuff, what do we do with the rest of it? They don't want to go there. They don't want to go there. So logic and reason would force them to start talking in terms of the actual historicity of the book of Genesis, and then of the Torah and the Exodus and the conquest and on through the rest of the Bible. The logic of it would force them to quit shaking their head when it comes to the Bible and start nodding, okay, yeah, this stuff really did happen. I think when it comes to still, in the face of evidence, still rejecting the historicity of the Bible, this is a personal moral choice. This is not an intellectual, evidential choice. It's not a scientific choice. In fact, what was interesting is that of the 21 authors, scientists on the first paper, of which I purposefully bowed out. I said, I know my archaeological community really well, and that most of my colleagues are going to be really resistant to this idea. So I don't want to be on there. And by the way, I told them, please don't even mention the Bible or the city of Sodom. But they came back at me and they said, wait a minute, we have to. It's there. If we ignore it and act like we don't know anything about it, other scholars are going to come back to us and say, what, did you ever see that? Did you not see that? Were you not aware of that? We don't want to get accused of that. So we have to say something. And here's what they said. This is all they said. They said, it is possible. In fact, I think they asked it as a question. Is it possible that this Middle Bronze Age meteoritic air burst destruction at Tal Hamam is the seedbed from which the story of Sodom in the Bible arose through some means? That's all they asked. It's a fair question. It's a question that anybody out there who researched even that deeply into it would ask. They have to ask it. And so they did. Well, guess what? There were a handful of people, not a lot. By the way, that paper is the most accessed scientific paper in the history of scientific journals. Set over 700,000 accessed that. That's crazy. I mean, most scientific papers, get a couple hundred, maybe 1,000 people who are interested in that stuff. But this thing went crazy. From 139 countries, people accessed this thing. It was off the charts. These liberals, that's a bad term. These anti-Bible people kind of came out of the woodwork. Not a lot of them, but they're very vocal. And they actually tried three times. They did three different waves of attacks on that paper to try to get Nature scientific reports to retract it. It not only went through the initial peer review to get published the first time, it went through a second peer review and a third peer review with all these questions and criticisms that were coming. And guess what hasn't been retracted? That paper is still there. It's not going anywhere. It has gone through three, maybe four peer reviews, and it's still there. And the follow-on paper is now published. But my point was this, Pat. I'd say three quarters of the 21 authors on that paper were not people of faith. I'm not saying they didn't have any kind of religious thought in their head whatsoever. Not what we would consider Christians or evangelical Christians, or I mean, one guy in the paper's name Siddhartha, you know, where does that even tell you? He's probably Buddhist. I don't know. But they did not write from a faith perspective. And I know many of these guys, and they don't have a particular religious perspective at all. They're just scientists. And guess what? The second paper is now out, and there will be another. They continue to research. And NASA and the United States government's very interested in this research because they want to know what would happen if one of these kinds of events that killed off Tal Hamam, Sodom, happened over New York or LA or Washington, D.C. They want to know. The answer is, if the same kind of size of event, by the way, this is the size of Tunguska, Siberia airburst 1908. That's a very important historical marker. A meteoritic airburst exploded over Tunguska, Siberia in 1908 and immediately incinerated 2,500 square kilometers of Siberian forest in a blink of an eye. And of course, the paper says that this event that destroyed Tal Hamam and the surrounding area was a Tunguska class meteoritic event. So it was big. If this kind of thing happened over, say, LA, there wouldn't be an LA. Chicago, that'd be toast for Chicago. That's all there is. This is a city killer, a big city killer. And so governments are interested in this sort of thing. How do we plan for this? Is there any kind of a way to plan for this sort of eventuality? Since there are like hundreds of these things floating around, zooming through space, you know, near misses all the time. What happens if one of these actually hits? And could we prevent it? And so even the governments, government scientists are paying attention to these publications. So has it gotten a little bit out of hand? Yes, I think it is what it is, Pat. But I'm hoping that the excitement of the meteoritic explosion doesn't supersede the message of the passage, which is, and if you go to Ezekiel 16, God tells us why he destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, because he says, I destroyed them because the people of Sodom were wealthy, overfed, unconcerned, did not take care of things like widows and orphans, and they did detestable things in my sight. And that's why I destroyed them. By the way, and he adds, as you have seen. Well, wait a minute. How did the Israelites of Ezekiel's day, or the Judahites of Ezekiel, how had they seen it? Well, you know, it's a picnic lunch walk from Jerusalem to go down into the valley and see the ruins that are there, the ruined cities that are there, especially in that day. Yeah. I mean, today you can even walk around and see them, but go back 3,000 years ago. How visible were they then? A lot. So there were hulking, burned out ruins back in the days of the Old Testament prophets that God could say, you know, and I destroyed those cities as you have seen. Go look, he said, go look and tell me that those cities aren't there. And they are there. They are still there today.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, I mean, there is a lesson to be learned from that that's relevant for us today. You elaborated on that a little bit, but what's that biblical lesson that we can take from learning about what God did to the city of Sodom, which is a historical event here?
We could say God is infinite and his qualities are infinite, but his patience is not. God just doesn't allow things that get counter to his nature go on forever. Yeah. God drew a line with the cities of the plain, and when they crossed the line and the limit that he had set for them, he destroyed them. And by the way, when I read the first time I read Ezekiel 16, you know, as an adult, I thought, wait a minute, you're arrogant, overfed, unconcerned, wealthy, don't take care of needy people. Who does that sound like in the modern world? And of course, detestable things. And the interesting thing was when God told the people through Ezekiel why he had destroyed Sodom, he never mentioned homosexuality. That was just one thing. That was just one thing. And I've often told people, if God destroyed ancient culture because of homosexuality, he'd have toasted the whole world because it was widely rampant, as rampant in the world as it was at Sodom. That was one problem Sodom had, but that wasn't the only problem Sodom had, because the Canaanites, who had the same problem, were crying out against Sodom. All the the people of the region were crying out against Sodom because of other issues. And so God destroyed them because of just a generic, you know, generic evil, wickedness. Yeah. I just heard the statistic this morning, you know, since Roe v. Wade began, something like 65 million
right.
children been destroyed in America. I mean, stop and think about that. That's a large nation, a fairly large nation of people. How long will God put up with us?
I remember Billy Graham near the end of his life, and Billy Graham's a fair guy. You know, he's not one of these guys that loses his head quickly. Yeah. And he said, if God doesn't judge America, he'll have to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. And that was a very sobering statement that he made. So it's not only a warning to America, but the churches as well, who refuse to address many of these tough passages and moral issues that the Bible talks about, and stories like Sodom and Gomorrah and the prophets. The churches need to be speaking out and proclaiming truth, even in these areas that the culture may find very difficult and tough to hear.
Yeah, I mean, when you get crossways with culture, that can be, you know, dangerous to your health. But the ancient prophets gave their lives. They were willing to put their lives on the line for the truth. There aren't too many people today who do that, not in the Christian community, not in any community, that will put their foot down and say, we can't tolerate this. Now, of course, I always go back to this, because how far do we go in addressing these kinds of issues in culture? Paul didn't write a single verse in all of his writings contra the Roman culture. Their practice of abortion, infanticide, all of those things was equally bad to what we do. But what Paul said, Paul's approach was this: unbelievers will be unbelievers, sinners will be sinners. What sinners do is sin. What evil people do is evil. And that's a given. So Paul chose to focus on the preaching of the gospel, on the declaration of the gospel that can change a heart.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't change a nation's viewpoint on things like abortion and many other issues without changing first their heart.
Mm-hmm.
You have to change the heart. The only thing, legislation doesn't change hearts.
Mm-hmm.
Marching and protests and fiery rhetoric from the pulpit or any place else doesn't change hearts. What changes hearts is a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That'll change your heart. And until your heart gets changed, you don't have the ability to think clearly about any of these issues.
Yes, it's very well said. Well, you know, it's been a fascinating discussion here. Man, if you want more information, Dr. Collins has written a great book on the discovery of Sodom. And you can also go, you know, on the internet. There's been several documentaries done on this now, right, Dr. Collins?
Yeah, I just came from a restaurant today. And a lady came up to me and said, oh, we watched you on TV yesterday. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they're out there. I think we've done 7 or 8 documentaries, mm-hmm. a couple for Discovery mm-hmm. Channel, I think 4 for National Geographic, and there's a bunch of them out there. And so you can see all this, but also we have a YouTube channel. Dr. Gary Byers and I have a little YouTube channel mm-hmm. called Troweling Down. And so if you'll check out Troweling Down, bunch of episodes on there where we talk about archaeology in the Bible. These are fun little episodes. And I've just launched a new writing series that we're going to announce. We're not quite announce it yet, but we're preparing the first editions. But we're going to be writing some little 2-3 page vignettes on a lot of this stuff. And just so people can have a quick bite that they can give to a friend or a pass off to somebody. So look for that. It's called Out of My Mind.
Great title. Yes. So, man, if you want to study this whole arena of biblical archaeology, Dr. Collins and his colleagues have a whole series on the internet. They've got books that they've written, but also you are the director of the archaeology program at Veritas International University. So if you want to study this stuff seriously and even earn a degree on that, it's Veritas International University. Tell us about the program, Dr. Collins.
Yes, this is very exciting. The program started about 5 or 6 years ago. Time flies so fast, hard to keep up with. Mm-hmm. We always wanted to have a nationally accredited master's and doctoral track in archaeology, and we call it archaeology in biblical history. It's archaeology done with a respectful focus on the Bible. It's unique. You can do it at distance, and you don't have to be on campus or anything like that. You can do it at distance. So these are very exciting programs. What we do is we teach people how to navigate through all of this material to see the organic relationship, cause and effect relationship between biblical history and ancient Near Eastern history, that the two really are this, they really are the same history, and they go together if they're properly understood and properly compared and integrated. So that's what we do. And we have, I think now in the Veritas program, I think we just crossed the 50 mark of 50, a little over 50 master's and doctoral students working on their degrees in our program. And that's very exciting. We want to triple that.
Yeah.
And the more the merrier. We're training up the next generation of people who are going to deal with archaeology and the Bible.
Yeah, I spend so much time defending the historical reliability of the Bible. And, you know, when I was looking for Near Eastern archaeology programs, there were several universities that had, but I didn't want to spend all that time and money studying under guys that didn't believe the Bible, and would spend a lot of time having to write under guys that probably wouldn't like my essays, or maybe wouldn't pass me, because they're coming from a very liberal perspective here. So when Joe Holden told me about the Veritas program, and it's one of a kind, being taught by a team of very high quality archaeologists who actually acknowledge the historical reliability of the Bible. And so that's really one of its kind. I don't know of any where you get to study under world-class archaeologists who come from that perspective.
Yeah, it's pretty rare, especially for distance, to be able to do it at a distance without having to, you know, pick up your life and your family and move,
yeah,
you know, off to a different city. And, you know, there's a couple of other good programs out there. You know, I have to mention Dr. Steve Ortiz's program over at Lipscomb University in Nashville. I have a terrific program, very similar. We have very similar programs. There's on, as far as I know, on campus only. And so they really focus on being there. But our program, you can be anywhere in the world. We literally have students around the world. Sometimes they get on a plane and come to Albuquerque and enjoy some live lectures every once in a while. And they meet us in the Middle East for excavations and things like that. You can do it all online. It's not an online study. All of our on-campus students and distance students do exactly the same work. The only difference is some attend the live lectures. Some attend, some listen to the lectures and classes archived online, or we actually live stream everything anyway. So we try to live stream everything so that if you're around the world, we often have people signing off. Oh, you know, we've got our student over here in Australia, you know, writes us in the chat on the side, says, I'm going to bed now. It's 3 in the morning. I can't do this anymore. So we have people signing off from all over the world. But it's all archived, too, so they can watch it after the fact. So we try to do everything possible to give students the opportunity to study archaeology and the Bible in depth at a profound graduate and doctoral level anywhere they are in the world.
Yes, it's a very exciting, outstanding program there. You've been listening to our interview with Dr. Stephen Collins, one of the top men in the field of biblical archaeology today. He's an author. He's a speaker. He's a defender of the faith, a director of the archaeological studies there at Veritas International University there in New Mexico. So Dr. Collins, man, great show. Thanks for being with us here on Evidence and Answers.
Thank you, Pat, for having me. We appreciate you and your ministry.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586, or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything ranging from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.